Hello, everybody, and what's up? Welcome to the first official episode of the Ruby Podcast, or the RubyCast for short. Now, obviously, the timing of the creation of this podcast might be a little bit off, seeing as how the final episode of Ruby Volume 6 just came out. And while it did have a few of its moments, personally, me, I thought that the Volume 6 finale was kind of on the lackluster side, but that does not take away from the fact that this was still a very, very nice volume, regardless. We'll be getting into that, but first, let me just go ahead and give you some of the basis for the reason why this podcast was made. And part of it was really just because of the fact that myself, I wasn't really able to find too many true Ruby-centric podcasts. There were more than a few Ruby role-playing podcasts, but I couldn't really find many that were centered around talking about the show as a whole. There were a few I saw, like one that specifically caught my eye just because I liked the name, was the Beacon Broadcast that's available on Apple Podcasts. I couldn't find it on Spotify, but I might have looked over it. But by any means, you know, it definitely is probably a podcast that I am going to check out myself. But just to give you guys a little bit of a rundown of what we're going to be doing on this podcast is, for today's episode, mainly, it's going to be talking about this volume as a whole and what really separated it. Because, realistically speaking, even though to me, you know, Volume 5, it improved on Volume 4, but it definitely was another miss instead of a hit. Volume 4 is definitely on the bottom of my list so far for the volumes. So Volume 6 was definitely a nice, refreshing breath of air. For what the past two volumes were basically just essentially lackluster, you know, I don't want to basically put down the writing that was made for volumes 4 and 5, but when you really do take a look at it, it really does seem as if it just wasn't there. But, you know, enough about those two. But again, as you may have seen in the description on this podcast, we are going to be talking about we're going to be doing episode reviews. The soundtrack is definitely going to be coming up, even though we still have about till late May, early June until it comes out. I'd like to think that maybe somehow we'll get it earlier, but after the past 2 years, probably not. It seems as if that May to June timetable is definitely the desired release timetable for the soundtrack, which is a bit of a shame, because this volume soundtrack has been on point, and I really do mean that. Out of all the songs we've heard snippets of, from Lionized to My Forever Fall, Rising, Nevermore, which the full song of that was released, of course, in the after credits scene, the audio wasn't too good. But however, if you do go on Flint of Ruby's YouTube channel, he has a much better version of it uploaded on his, and the official lyrics that he got from Jeff and Casey Williams themselves. Which, 9 out of 10, if you're listening to this podcast, you already know who Flint is. Most people in the fandom do. But yeah, no, the soundtrack this year, I believe it's, what, 8 or 7 tracks? I think it's 8 tracks. Yeah, no, it every single track was just, they fit really, really well. Personally, my favorite right now, after going back and listening to the snippets of it, even though we only got about a 30-second snippet of it, Indomitable really seems as if it's going to be possibly the best one on the soundtrack, you know? Just because, like, it's been so long since we've gotten, like, a theme for Ruby, like, honestly. You know, I've seen some people say that, well, you know, it sounds as if Triumph could have been, you know, a song mostly about Ruby, but that's more so, you know, the intro songs, for the most part, are always talking, well, the intro songs now are more so talking about, you know, all the characters themselves. You know, Volumes 1 and 2, especially Volume 1, you definitely could have argued that those were more so about Ruby Rose herself. But, yeah, no. Indomitable, it just has a very kind of, I think you could say it kind of has an inspirational feel to it. Because there's definitely, like, I think it was just the buildup of the scene itself. You know, where it's where she's trying to use her silver eyes on the first attempt against the Leviathan. You know, the memories, they start out well, but then she starts thinking about Pyrrha's death, Penny, you know, just all the bad things that have happened. And then, of course, she ends up summoning Jin just out of, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to try to buy more time for herself, which Jin allowed her that one time to do it. Not exactly sure why. You know, maybe, you know, the next time we see Jin, you know, she'll tell Ruby as to why she allowed it. Maybe it's just because she naturally is against the forces of Grimm, and so therefore didn't really have too much of a problem with helping Ruby, excuse me, get more time to use her Silver Eye powers. But then, on the second attempt, it starts focusing on, you know, a lot more of the better times, and, you know, showing the people that Ruby loves and who she wants to protect, with this flashback's ending to the reveal of Summer. Now, I figured it was probably going to be here in... it was either going to be next volume or volume 8 that we were finally going to get to see, you know, a full character model for Summer and what she looked like. But instead, we got it in the finale of the volume. And it's really just an adult Ruby? Granted, you know, I mean, I think most people kind of figured that Ruby would have to look mostly like Summer because she doesn't look like Ty at all. So yeah, no, Summer basically just looks like a grown-up Ruby. But that really did make the scene, because it shows that even to this day, Ruby is still constantly using her mother as a motivation. Another song off the soundtrack that I'm really looking forward to is Neo's theme, which I can't remember the official name for it. I think it's One Thing. One Thing sounds about right. But yeah, no, just because it just has a badass feel to it. And I like the badass songs off the soundtrack. Like, songs like I'm the One have been my favorite songs to come off the Ruby soundtracks, you know? Not so much the sadder songs or some of the more upbeat songs, like Boop or Neon or Caffeine, but it's always been more ones like Lucis Natore, I'm the One, All Things Must Die, Bad Luck Charm, ones like that. Like, those are always, those are the ones that I constantly listen to on repeat, which granted that could just be because of my own personal preference to, like, alternative metal, punk rock, stuff like that. And in all honesty, Miracle. Because Miracle to me sounded as if it really could have been the opening for the volume. You know, especially because of the line where, I believe it's a verse that Casey does, where part of it is where she says, "Our triumphs haven't mattered," which is a direct opposite to the opening for Volume 5, Triumphs. And I just thought that was nice to see, because it really does, you know, because in the first few, after, you know, we get a preview of the battle that they end up getting to on the train that's headed to Argus, when they're just in the train station, Crow's reading out, we hear Crow reading out the letter he's sending to Ironwood. Ruby is just excited, and she ends up zipping all the way through the train station. And that nice little scene really made it seem at first that this volume was going to have more of a, you know, bit more of a laid-back approach to it. And, quickly wasn't the case. which we'll use that to segue just into the review of this volume as a whole. And we'll start off with, again, that first episode. Now, in the first episode, which keep in mind, I'm not going to go ahead and, you know, be able to act as if an entire encyclopedia for all of Volume 6, just because, like, my whole mindset for this volume was just like, all right, volume one's done. Okay, I'll think about this for a few days, and I'm immediately on to thinking about volume two and what that could entail. But volume one, it starts off, you know, with us seeing them battling the Manticores and the Sphinx on the train, and it gives us a little snippet, which it ends with Oscar yelling out about the tunnel, and then it cuts back to them in the train station. And, you know, we, again, the whole part with the letter to Ironwood from Crow, you know, to the nice little interaction between Yang and Ruby with the gift bag, which we still don't know what's in that damn gift bag, which, you know, maybe we'll find out episode one of volume 7 maybe, you know, just as like a little gag moment for comic relief, along with Nora talking about how she's so excited to see like the beautiful coastlines of Argus and then asking if it's, you know, too early for swim season. And then we get the unexpected thought bubble from Ren holding a beach ball on the beach, which that part I found funny just because, you know, I didn't expect that from Ren. I honestly didn't. But then we meet two huntsmen who I'm pretty sure are based off of Tweedledee and Dum just because one of them is named D. So that just makes sense to me. And then trying to be all cocky and arrogant when they don't even realize that, you know, none of these girls are huntsmen or huntresses just because, you know, it's not like they're dressed different than any regular civilians, but, you know, the whole Tweedledee, Tweedledum thing. And then we get back to the train being attacked after, you know, everyone is in their own compartments. And that battle itself, just the train battle in general, was just a nice sequence, in my opinion, just because of all the different team attack moments, like with, you know, Yang and Blake using Gamble Shroud to basically, like, corral one of the Grimm to the scene towards the end of it to where Ruby ends up using her semblance to save, or, well, she grabs Weiss before she falls off the train, but then she uses her semblance to get back inside the train before it's too late. But Volume 1 also was... God, Volume 1. Episode 1 also was kind of just like a basis for how I think this volume was going to go. Mainly just because of the fact that, you know, once we really do start taking a look at how the general feel of it, it really did seem as if that anytime they thought, you know, they were going to be getting any downtime, which I apologize for the keyboard typing in the background. But yeah, no, it was really just seemed as if any time the gang ended up thinking that they could finally have some downtime, that went right out the window. And I mean completely out the window, to the point to where, like, anytime something good happened, you know, you immediately start thinking, okay, what's going to happen to discourage this? You know, like, it was really something that you never, there was never a point in time to where anything good happened that I personally didn't go, well, that's going to come back and bite him in the ass, basically. And then eventually, you know, Volume 1 ends with, you know, the train, well, the half of the train that Team Ruby, Crow, and Oscar are on, being destroyed by the Alpha of the Pack of Grimm that attacked them. And while they're all, you know, broken about, checking to make sure none of them are injured, we meet Maria, who ended up being possibly my favorite side character in the whole series. Just because here's this old lady that you think of just like, well, I mean, she's probably here, you know, to expel wisdom of some kind, which she does end up doing. Because almost as soon as she is unveiled because of the goggle-like thing she's wearing, people immediately start going, there's no way she's not a silver-eyed warrior. You know, that's got to be it. Like, something happened. You know, she fucked up her eyes somehow. And the Phantom was spot on. And then in Volume 2, you know, we find out that Cinder isn't dead, which I don't think a lot of people actually thought she was dead. Just because the whole, you know, it's been said time and time again, with a lot of different forms of media, no body, no death. And all we saw was Cinder fall into a chasm, I think that's what it's called, or an abyss. So yeah, no, it really wasn't safe to assume she was dead, just yet. And then, of course, you know, she was thawing out, basically, which I think the only reason, personally, me and myself, I think the only reason why she could have survived that with her aura shattered was the fact that she's a maiden. You know, like, I don't think if, you know, if, like, Crow were to have had that happen to him, he wouldn't have survived. But we find out Cinder's still alive, and the first thing she does after breaking out of that vault and pulling her broken ego and herself out of, out of the vault at Haven, she kills. Because, you know, villain. And then she ends up finding herself in the slums of Mistral that we, you know, first heard about in A World of Remnant, and then it was shown a little bit in Volume 5 in the first episode. And then she ends up meeting a information broker known as Little Miss Malachite. Now, me, myself, when I first heard that name, I immediately thought of the Malachite twins in the first two volumes of Ruby. Now, I can't exactly remember if their last name was spelled the same as Little Miss. I'll be sure to check that after this episode goes up. But I'm almost sure that it was spelled the exact same way. Now, if they have any actual relation to each other, we don't know. The only way we're going to find out about that is when the gang eventually ends up going back to Vale to find the relic under Beacon. Which that's probably not to, that's probably closer to like the end game, you know, like that's probably not going to happen until like the last few volumes, in my opinion, at least. I could be wrong, you know, I for sure didn't expect that the Relic of Knowledge was going to have a genie in it at all, but lo and behold, it did. But then, you know, Ruby ends up asking Miss Malachite if she had any information on any of Team Ruby, to which she doesn't say she does. She just tells Cinder, you know, give us some time, we'll find them, you know. But then one of Miss Malachite's henchmen ends up saying they already knew where they were, but they didn't know who was asking about Cinder. And immediately people are wondering who this is. You know, obviously they mentioned the big guy. And, you know, the big guy in Ruby so far, it's Hazel. You know, unless Yatsuhashi ended up turning heel. You know, it's Hazel who was asking about him. But then we cut back to Team Ruby in, you know, on the outskirts of Argus. I don't know if they actually named that wooded area, but I just call it the outskirts of Argus just because that has a better ring to it for me. And to which they're all frustrated, they're upset, because, you know, they now know that the relic, it attracts Grimm. It's been attracting Grimm, which, honestly, you know, during the scene where Oz is talking about, you know, what the relic can do, its drawbacks, you know, three questions every 100 years, to which he then spun the little lie of, oh, but you know, we can't use it right now because by the time I came into knowledge of it, all three questions had already been asked. But you would think at that point in time, you know, that's when you should probably say, oh yeah, by the way, this thing kind of is a magnet for Grimm. But it doesn't, because, you know, paranoia is a bitch. But that's also why, like, I was originally, after this episode aired, you know, even after Ozpin's rant about how, like, you know, it'd be stupid of him to just completely put his trust in Team Ruby because he's been betrayed before. But granted, you know, you can kind of tell that none of them are the, you know, backstabbing type. Like, I don't see any of, well, you know, Yang was kind of peeved. You know, she's been the most pissed off about it. I was just about to say, I don't see any of Team Ruby, you know, being like Raven. And once she figures out everything Ozpin's been hiding, they basically go, fuck you, fuck everyone else, I'm going out my own. But still, Yang's not going to abandon her team and Team Junior. Because that's her fam, you know? Like, at this point, it's a little bit too late for any of them to be like, I'm going rogue. You know, like, it's just, at this point, you know, it's kind of like, eh, we gotta get through everything now. But then, you know, we come to find out that when Ozpin is, the minute Ozpin realizes he doesn't have the relic on himself, he starts getting paranoid, right? And so, you know, he starts telling Ruby, you know, the relic is safer in his hands, to which we find out that Oscar can actually fight back against Oz's control. And I think that's going to be a real biggie, you know, for the future until Oz and Oscar completely merge. Because, you know, that could really, and I haven't seen too many people talking about this, but I think that could really end up forming the basis of, you know, who ends up being more apparent once that merge has fully happened. Is it going to be more Oz, or is it going to be more Oscar once that merge fully happens? And now that Oscar has shown that he can, you know, fight back whenever Oz decides to take the wheel for himself, you know, I think that could end up being, you know, a really big point for Oscar's development. You know, especially because of the fact that in the next episode, Oscar says, you know, I'm just another one of his lives, aren't I? And I really do think that so long as Oscar ends up realizing that he can still end up staying in control in some form of way, that won't be entirely true. But back to what happened in Volume 2, towards the end of the episode, in that same scene, Oscar says, Jin, her name is Jin, he's hiding something from you, say her name to Summoner, to which Ruby does, and Big Blue Naked Genie. Which again, that was a shock. You know, like, I figured that the relics had some sort of magic in them, but I didn't think they had any kind of, like, spiritual kind of thing. And then, Ruby asks Jin, what is Ozpin hiding from us? And we finally, at that point, know, you know, we're finally getting much-needed backstory on Oz. But what we didn't know we were going to be getting was also Salem's backstory. Because we find out Salem was human at one point. She wasn't always this dark mistress of Grimm. She was human. And, you know, in episode 3, you know, Jin starts telling the tale of how, you know, Salem was a young woman locked in a tower by her overbearing father, and where many men had failed to try to free Salem, you know, over the promises of, like, rewards or stuff like that. Ozpin, who at this point in his life was known as Ozma, was just doing it because he thought it was the right thing. You know, he was doing it because he thought that that was no way for someone to live. And then, of course, you know, after he saves her, the old cliche of, oh, they fall in love. But then, you know, Ozma ends up dying from an illness. To which Salem immediately, you know, she ends up, you know, it doesn't sit with her well, you know, which is, you know, that's expected. You know, this girl has been locked in a tower her whole life, finally finds someone she can fall in love with, and they die. Naturally, you're gonna become a bit hysterical after that happens, so at first she goes to the gods, and the first one she goes to is the God of Light, and we finally get to see what the gods look like, and the God of Light is this big, you know, hulking figure who just completely towers over Salem, who has what look like deer horns. It looks like a buck. But then when she begs that he revive Ozma, the God of Light tells her, you know, no, there is a delicate balance that exists in this world, and even though I feel for your pain, and basically says, you know, you're right, he was too young to die, this is the way things have to be. We cannot upset the balance. And then Salem continues to demand that the God of Light bring him back. And he basically says, for the last time, no. Let him rest. Let him finally seek peace and comfort in death, or there will be consequences. And so Salem doesn't listen to this, and she goes to the God of Darkness. Personally, between me, I don't know about you guys, but the God of Darkness was my favorite between the two. From the way they animated him to you know, his outlook on things to, this could be saying something about me. I might just end up, you know, I like characters with very questionable methods that are done correctly. And I thought they did a good job of portraying, you know, the God of Darkness. And it's also his voice actor. Like, his voice actor was fucking spot on with how he portrayed the God of Darkness. But, you know, because the God of Darkness has never had anyone, you know, come to him and pray to him and beg him for help, he does it. He rewards Salem for, you know, in his mind, coming to the right person. You know, like, he's really just like, this is something I can hold over my brother's head. And what do you know, after Ozma's revived and freaks out because he looks around and he's surrounded by Grimm, and this scrawny but still very intimidating dark purple figure with twisted horns. But then, immediately after that happens, we hear a crack of thunder, and the God of Light is there, and he is pissed. He's pissed. You know, his brother went back on the balance that they agreed upon, you know, but at the time, you know, he didn't know Salem went to him first. He took it as an insult because he thought, you know, and his literal line is something along the lines of, you know, but the day a mortal comes to worship me at my own feet or something like that, you know, you take offense to it when I have never done that to you. But then, you know, the older brother, he gives him the lowdown, says, you're being played. She came to me before. She's trying to hurt at the balance that we created together as brothers. And then, you know, the God of Darkness, he, you know, after him and his brother were, like, going back and forth between killing Ozma and reincarnating him, killing Ozma and bringing him back, he finally kills Ozma off for good. And then, you know, Salem, in a blind rage, begins to try to attack the God of Light, and the God of Light basically in his dragon form. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that. They apparently could turn into dragons. It's pretty damn cool. But he rushes her in his dragon form, and then the scene immediately cuts to her falling from the sky into the pools of, I think the Phantom simply called it, like, the Lake of Reincarnation. It was something like that. It was something to evolve with, like, reincarnation. But she comes up, and the first thing she sees is that her body glimmers. To which, you know, after she asks what they did, the older brother explains that she has been made immortal. And Salem clearly asks about this, and then the little brother explains to her, you can't die. And then there was this really cool shot to where it has both the brothers' faces, you know, the little brother, the God of Darkness, his face is coming down, the God of Light, his face is coming up, they're coming to merge. And I can't remember this is the exact line, and I really wish I could, because it was one of my most favorite lines in the entire series. And it was something along the lines of, so long as you cannot understand the true meaning of depth, you will be cursed to forever walk this earth. And then once their faces meet, it fades to Salem's. To which then Salem is then teleported outside of the God of Light's area. And she's basically now, she's cursed to forever walk the earth. You know, it's Jin basically explains, you know, Salem tried multiple different ways to kill herself until she finally decides, you know what? If I was able to turn these two brothers, I was able to turn gods against each other. What if I form an army to go against them? And that's what she does. She goes around the world, you know, recruiting, telling them of her stories of how she stole power itself from the gods, you know, and just, Jin says, the hearts of men are easily swayed. And that's proven because she is able to get this, at least I think it was 4 different factions or armies to join in her cause, and they end up going to the God of Light's domain. And he and his, and the God of Darkness are there, and the older brother asks, you know, why are you doing this? Who led you down this path? To which they see Salem walk up, and she and everyone else there starts using their magic to try to attack. when the God of Darkness pulls the biggest fucking trump card we have seen in the series so far in action and catches it. He Dragon Ball Z's the shit, basically. To which he delivers the line, "My own gift given to them, used against me." He crushes it and boom. Everything is gone. Everyone's dead. Except Salem. You know, and she doesn't realize this. She thought, oh, okay, that probably only eviscerated half of the population. To which then the God of Darkness says, nope, you're all that's left. Have fun with that. And then, you know, both the gods leave. And in the process, the God of Darkness destroys the moon. And then, you know, Salem ends up trying to kill herself for the last time with Brothers Grimm's pool of a lot of annihilation, and then she becomes the Salem we know. And within that time period of her existing like this and just trying to, like, just basically brooding the whole time, Ozma is brought back to life. He is given a choice by the God of Light to right Salem's wrong. Keep in mind, this is where people really started turning against the brothers, because the brothers refused to accept responsibility, specifically the God of Light. He basically said everything that has happened is Salem's fault when, you know, hate to break it to you, bud, but you definitely played a huge part in it. You know, this woman became the way she is because you just couldn't make an exemption like one time. Like, I get having a set of morals and a code to go by, but, like, this was probably, like, you know, they make it seem as if she was the only woman who came to the gods to ask of this. Now, I doubt that she was, but, you know, it was also, like, I don't know, there's probably a few different ways they could have, that the God of Light could have gone about, you know, telling Salem, this is why I can't do it, instead of just being like, nope, this is the rules, we're not gonna do it. Instead of, you know, but that's what he did. But Ozma's brought back, and thus we see his different periods of reincarnation. And we actually find out that he and Salem, they end up reuniting. And for a period of time, Ozma forgets his mission. He forgets that he's supposed to be fighting against Salem. Forgets that he's supposed to be tracking down the four relics of knowledge, creation, destruction, and I should not be forgetting this. Oh, God. What is it? Creation, knowledge, destruction. Fuck. Google, help me. Help me. Please. Oh, God, what was it? Knowledge, creation, destruction. Destruction. Choice. Relic. God, I'm an idiot. Creation, destruction, knowledge, and choice. Okay, for once, the Ruby wiki actually came through. But yeah, no, he's supposed to be looking for these four things, but instead he completely forgets about that. He ends up starting a family with Salem with, ironically enough, four daughters. All of whom showed they were able to use magic. And this ends up starting a theory of, were those the original four maidens? But then, you know, when Ozpin ends up telling Salem about what he's really supposed to be doing, you know, they obviously completely disagree with that. Ozpin tries to leave Salem with their daughters. They basically end up having a Harry Potter, you know, battle, basically, with the way that scene with, like, magic just being thrown around willy-nilly. And we see a bear that is burned up. And we're led to believe that the four daughters died. Which, for some people, that immediately made them think, oh, well, okay, I guess those can't be the four maidens. But then, here's something to keep mind of. Ozpin and Salem are technically immortal. So what if the four maidens ended up inheriting Ozpin's reincarnation curse? I'm not going to call it powers because, you know, that kind of it, when you're forced to basically be like, yeah, you can't experience peace and death until you kill your ex. Or your baby mama or wife. It doesn't say, I think, if they were married or not. I'm just going to assume, you know, they did get married. But yeah, no, it is a curse. But what if, you know, we don't know. You know, even though Oz can win the depth with the Tale of the Four Seasons or Maidens with Pyrrha, you know, maybe, you know, that's another thing he's hiding. Which, you know, Grant, I think if he did tell them that, you know, Team Ruby and Junior would probably be like, well, you know, there were those four daughters you guys had. But anyway, and then Ozpin goes through this depressed cycle of, like, constantly reincarnating, and he basically says, I don't care about the mission, I'm sick of this, I hate it all, until he does pick it back up, to which he ends up finding Jin's lamp, and he uses the three questions. He asks, two of them, or what are the relics, where can I find the relics, and how do I, keep in mind people, listen to that, I defeat Salem, to which he says, you can't. And so then, in the next few episodes, we basically, this basically ends up creating this whole thing to where, you know, in retaliation, you know, they start taking their frustrations out. Oscar Crow literally punches a fucking 14-year-old, so that's always nice. You know, I get the reason why Crow had a knee-jerk reaction like that, but maybe not punch Oscar? Like, I personally, even though it still would have been messed up either way, maybe just, like, verbally lash out at him and then, like, do one of those fake-outs where he thinks you're going to punch him, but you just end up punching the tree just by his head, you know. But instead, he gets punched in the head or in the cheek, to which they end up going to Abernathy Farms. And when they're trying to clear out rooms and everything like that, just take shelter from the storm or the snowstorm, they end up finding out that... you know, the whole town is dead. Also, I forgot, you know, Ozpin then, in that fort time, before they get to Abernathy Farms, they basically tell, you know, he tells Team Ruby and Crow, there is no plan. I've basically been fighting a losing battle. And I think that's actually what leads to, Crow punching Oscar. And also, we see the scene where Emerald and Mercury and Hazel have to report the incident of Haven to Salem, with which we see Salem thoroughly lose her shit for the first time. Like, she basically, like, conjures grim hands to, like, just basically try to pull Hazel down into hell. You know, she flips a table on Tyrion, who is her only fan at this point. She forces Emerald to say how, you know, this is Cinder's fault. You all fail because of Cinder. Because she knows, she would have told Mercury to say that, Mercury would have been like, Cinders? Like, he would have said immediately. She knows what she's doing by asking that to Emerald. Emerald thinks Cinder cares about her. She thinks Cinder is like, she thinks Cinder is the only person that truly, truly cares about her. But, then, you know, the episode ends with them getting to Abernathy Farms, and then, and then, you know, in the next episode, Cinder, she goes back to Malachite to ask how the progress is going. And then, what do you know, Neo's back. Because she was the person who turned out was going to be asking about Cinder. They have a nice little, you know, they have a really nice fight, to where, you know, one thing is playing in the background. They basically completely tear up the bar that Miss Malachite and the spiders were staying at, before, you know, Cinder is able to convince Neo. You know, I'm not responsible for Roman's death. Ruby is. You know, we each have our own reasons to wanting to kill Ruby. Let's put our differences aside now and hunt her down. Which I don't see, you know, this partnership being genuine. Both of them kind of seem as if the minute they get any kind of success for this plan, they think... Alright, sorry about that. I had to go help somebody with something, but yeah. But once they're at Abernathy Farm, you know... We find out, you know, about how, find out about the Abernathy Farm. We find out about the apathy, which kind of like the Dementors from Harry Potter. You know, we get the scene where Maria ends up helping Ruby, you know, unlock how to activate her silver eyes at will. And then, you know, following that, we see, you know, the scene or the flashback of Maria's past where, you know, shows her when she was a younger woman, you know, just the scene overall of her, like, taking down the Nevermore, I think was probably, like, the best part of that episode, And that's saying a lot given of how much I enjoyed the second half of it. Yeah, no, and it's just like, just that scene overall really showed just how, you know, and it's kind of tragic because it showed just how badass Maria was. But just like that one injury from old TikTok Croc. I know that's not her actual name, but, you know, I just like saying that. Just the one slice of the ice from the Cutlass, and she said how, you know, because of the injury and being hunted down, she was too afraid to fulfill her duties as a huntsman anymore. But it filled her with happiness knowing that, like, it definitely seemed as if this next generation was up to the task. And, but then, you know, as they're continuing on with the conversation, and Maria asks, or Ruby asks Maria if she would help teach Ruby. Ruby ends up getting a phone call from Jean, and this caught him off guard because there's no way that Jean should be able to reach them until Ruby points her scroll in the direction they're going, and she notices the signal growing stronger, and Jean mentions how, like, he's been trying to reach them ever since they made it to Argus, and lo and behold, we get the reveal of Argus, which is basically like San Francisco. You know, with the trolley cars, the very, very steep elevation where the houses are located. But yeah, no, that was just... The second half of that episode was just, like, really nice and fun to watch. Because of the fact that, you know, it shows all of them reuniting. And then, you know, we get a little backstory on how Argus came to be and why it was able to survive despite the fact that it was a settlement attempt outside of Mistral. Or, Haven. Well, yeah, no, Mistral. Haven's the, Huntsman School. But yeah, no, and it was, you know, and then we find out that Team Junior had been staying with Saffron, Jean's older sister, one of his seven sisters, and she has with her little baby Adrian. And, you know, then we get that nice scene where it's, you know, Team Ruby and Junior in Saffron's house. You know, they're all settling in, and then, you know, we see that we find out that Saffron is married to a woman. And, you know, I think the way that Rushi did this was probably the best way they could have. You know, they didn't have any of the characters being like, oh my god, wait, what, you're married to a woman? All of them were just like, oh, hey, sup. But yeah, no, and then, like, the dinner scene, and then with, Terracotta having to take the phone call and just... Which I thought it was funny when, you know, Saffron, when she, like, was explaining what was going wrong with work, and she, like, starts baby talking to Adrian, and then when she's just like, guess who's getting blamed, and Terracotta just comes around and just like, oh, me. Yeah, no, and then, but obviously, as these past few volumes of Ruby taught us, anytime something good happens, something bad is gonna happen. And with that, you know, in the next episode, they go to the Argus base, where Team Junior already tried to get help, but of course had the door slammed on him. But of course, you know, Team Ruby, they have more pulling factor because they have the, for as much as they know, the heirs to the Shinied Dust Company with them. And so they try to use her as a card, and then we meet the specialist that's at the base, which everyone thought was going to be Winter, but turns out it's Cordova. Kind of a letdown, but you know, like, it made up for it because she was still a pretty... She was a funny character in my mind. You know, like, I was never really able to get pissed at her, mainly just because of the two idiots who were guarding the gate I thought were really funny, even if, like, their hats were probably the most impractical thing I've ever seen. And her interactions with Maria and, you know, before we meet Cordovan, you know, Maria's just like, oh, you bring cashews on one flight. But then, you know, once they get the door slammed in their face after Cordovan makes what could be interpreted as a racist comment or a comment on how, you know, the whole world saw Yang's, you know, Yang breaking Mercury's leg when Emerald was using her semblance in the Vital Tournament. And then they get turned away and, you know, Crow ends up storming off to go drink again. And then we get the inevitable scene of Team Junior finding out about Ospin hiding more secrets. and they explain to them what happened. Obviously, you know, they're all upset. Bijan ends up being the most pissed off. He ends up punching a hole in his sister's house. Still don't know if that got repaired or not. I guess we never will. And then, you know, the confrontation from the intro that we saw with him shoving Oscar against the wall ends up happening, and Jean ends up accusing Oscar of not even really being Oscar, and that's been Oz covering, doing like a cover-up job the whole time. And Jean doesn't stop until Ruby finally gets on him. And he looks slightly guilty after that, but still, you can tell he's upset. He ends up storming upstairs to where, you know, Ren and Nora, they end up following him. But then we get the scene with, you know, we get more Silver Eyed Warrior lore with Maria and Ruby. And, you know, we see, and Maria starts explaining to Ruby, you know, you're looking at your powers in the wrong way. You should be looking at them as a way to not just protect the people you know and the ones you love, but humanity as a whole. And she explains how, you know, like, her father was a Silver Eyed Warrior, but he didn't know much about him. So he had to self-learn everything. But, you know, he figured, you know, because of the fact that there was so little information on them, one, they had to be kind of a thing of legend, and also, you know, there had to have been a reason why there weren't many left. But we also, in that point, learn Maria's semblance, which basically allows her to tell, you know, when things are going to happen before, you know, a few seconds before they happen, which I think she dubbed preflexes. You know, after they have that nice little chat, Ruby comes back to the house, you know, to have everyone being like, so Oscar left. And immediately they all assume, you know, especially Jean, you know, Jean basically has a thing of, you know, this is all my fault. You know, I snapped at him, you know. And now, you know, the next episode, they have to go looking for him. And this fucking episode, oh my God. I'm not gonna lie, I cried. As did a lot of other people. But, you know, we see, you know, we never seen Team Ruby looking for Oscar. It's Junior-centric, or Juniper. And Saffron's with him, and, you know, she's trying to, she basically, you know, thinks it's like, you know, obviously they can't tell Saffron what's the real reason why they're there. And so she's just like, you know, you guys could always just end up go to Mistral and end up coming back living in Argus. You know, be this town's huntsman. And, you know, they tell her, you know, it's more complicated than that. So Ren and Nora go to get either hot chocolate or coffee. I think it was hot chocolate. But Jean ends up sitting on a bench. And while he's sitting there, we see a little leaf skipping across the ground. And immediately, like, this is just a rule that I hope people have picked up on. Whenever things start to get downtrodden with one character, and you hear piano keys or a very light instrumental or, you know, Casey humming, it's not going to be a good time. You're going to cry. You know, it's going to be real heavy on the feels. And so Jean ends up following this leaf into a courtyard. Meanwhile, You're My Forever Fall starts playing in the background, and we get different shots revealing a statue dedicated to Pyrrha. And while Jean comes across this and he's just staring up at it, clearly, like, starting to, you know, really, you know, if that had been Volume 4, would have already broken down at that point. He ends up having this woman coming up to him. And this woman looks very, very similar to Pyrrha. And, you know, but granted, you know, in the end credits for that episode, she didn't have a name. She was just known as a red-haired woman. You know, some people think it's like a reincarnated spirit of Pyrrha's, you know, trying to, like, you know, explain to Jean why, you know, she understands why, you know, he hasn't been able to handle things very well, but why he also needs to just, like, be able to, you know, find closure, knowing that, you know, they're still, you know, she's still with them and that, you know, she's still fighting, and other people see it as her mom. Me personally, I think it's her mom, you know, but because of the fact that, you know, this might have been a one-off appearance, you know, maybe Kurobe just didn't decide to give her a name, just leave it up to fan interpretations, whatever. And then they have their conversation, and then, you know, Ren and Nora come back. They see that, you know, Jean's there with the statue, but the red-haired woman's already gone. All that's left are the flowers that she brought, and then, you know, Jean explains how he's been a bad leader. But then Nora also says, you know, we know how hard you've been on yourself. We heard what you said at Haven, and you need to stop. Because you're our family, and we're not going to lose any more family. And then, you know, they meet up with Team Ruby again, and they ask, oh, you know, where's Oscar? Did you guys find him? Nope. Turns out Oscar just decided to go shopping for a new apparel. That's it. Now, there are some people who think that, you know, that was Ospin talking, just because of the way his speech was. And I could definitely see why. You know, that definitely didn't sound like Oscar until, you know, the part about the casserole came up. But then, you know, we, and then, you know, we get the scene where Jean brings up his plan of, I mean, if they won't give us an airship, why not just steal one? So this went GTA real fucking quick, but sure enough, you know, Ruby, after Crows tries to denounce it, Ruby's like, no, we've done things your way, now we're going to do it our way. And that leads to, you know, in the next episode of Weiss smuggling Maria in a bag, and just, like, it starts out really comical, but obviously, you know, Maria figures out that, you know, Weiss and Maria have hijacked a ship, and in response to that, Maria goes a bit overboard and starts using a mech to try to fight them. Meanwhile, Blake and Yang have gone to the CCT tower that is in Argus to hack it to cut off the comms, but the reason why, you know, and this tale figures into as to why, you know, the military base was able to tell that, you know, the ship that they stole, designated as the Manta 5-1, was able to be detected back. It's because Blake never got the chance because Adam shows up doing the Bird Box Challenge. He's trendy. And so then that leads to, you know, their confrontation. And so now, you know, in the last few episodes, we end up seeing, we know we're going to end up seeing a Genlock cameo and a Bird Box cameo. Rooster Teeth's really on top of their shit when it comes to knowing what to, you know, plug. But all joking aside, you know, the mech battle for me was an afterthought. I didn't even care about that. I was just like, show the handicap match. And I don't, well, okay, that could kind of be taken as a really fucked up pun because, you know, Yang's got a robot arm. I meant handicap as in, like, 2-on-1, you know. Keep in mind, people, I'm a wrestling fan, so, you know, you'll hear me sneak in wrestling terminology here and there, like how I made the heel comment in the first half of recording this. Yeah, no, it starts out with Blake and Adam fighting, and, you know, they're going through the force. Blake is just, like, trying to create distance between herself and Adam, get it into a more open area, you know. Adam's throwing, like, verbal barbs at her, trying to, like, get her to mess up. And then they get to that little, I don't even know what you would call that. I would assume it could just be called a land bridge. But that land bridge with the waterfall behind him. And then, you know, Adam ends up disarming Blake. And then we finally get the reveal of Adam's face. You know, what it was going to be. You know, some people thought he was a Silver-Eyed Warrior. You know, others did think it was a scar. But it was a much more worse scar than we knew it was going to be, because he literally has the Schneedust Company brand on his fucking eye. And this may sound a little fucked up, but I honestly want to see a flashback of Adam getting that. Like, even though obviously now, you know, Adam can't exactly tell the story of how he got it. But, like, maybe in Atlas, you know, they'll run into, like, because, you know, maybe Adam worked in the dust mine for the Schneedust Company as a kid. And, you know, maybe Team Ruby in Volume 7 will run into, like, the foreman of the mine who will, like, joke about it and recall it. Or we'll meet another Faunus who, like, you know, maybe they looked over Adam. Because, you know, at this point, we're led to believe that Adam was an orphan. You know, he you know, no Faunus, who's tied in with Adam in any way, has made any comment about his parents. You know, I'm hoping we'll get to see how that exactly happened. But, you know, the fight continues, and as he's revealing the scar, you know, he tells Blake, you know, people hurt me in so many different ways long before I ever met you. And, well, he got to add another thing to that list because he literally had a fucking motorcycle landed on him. And then, you know, Yang enters the fight. And at this point, this is what, you know, even if you aren't a Bumblebee shipper, this is one of the fights you've been wanting to see since Volume 3. You want to see how Yang and Blake are going to go against Adam. Overall, I thought the fight between the three, between the three, was pretty good, you know? There were a few other things I would have liked to see more, like, you know, but a lot of it is mainly just to build tension, you know, and make fans, you know, who, you know, especially for, like, just because, you know, bit of an asshole when it comes to writing stuff like this, because I just think, you know, the more tension you have in a fight scene, the better it gets. You know, maybe, you know, Yang's PTSD, you know, affects her way too much, and she isn't able to, you know, focus clearly as well as she did, even though she did still have Blake there to help. but then, you know, before the second half of that fight, you know, at the end of that episode, you know, Adam, you know, makes the offhand comment just like, oh, you know, so she is protecting you now. And then Blake says, neither of us are protecting the other. We're protecting each other. The handhold. And if that didn't get the bees fucking stirring, the next episode, Adam starts saying stuff just like, you know, she made a promise to me once. And look how well that went. But then Yang fires back with, you know, did she make that promise to you or the guy you were pretending to be? And then, you know, he keeps saying stuff like, you know, what is she even seeing you, this, that, yada, yada, yada. And so obviously, you know, that, to me, that's got to, like, put that shit being confirmed as canon at about a 90% chance. And then, you know, Blake, her aura breaks, and, you know, so she gets knocked out of the fight, and then the process begins climbing the wall behind them, which I'm still trying to figure out how the next sequence of events happened. She was climbing up when she popped up. Unless, like, there was a scene that I missed or a frame where, like, you know, she jumps down to an area where she wouldn't have just fallen into the river, but whatever. Then, you know, it's finally Yang and Adam one-on-one. You know, Adam makes, before the fight starts, he's just like, well, Yang, have you gotten faster since Beacon? And then he notices how Yang's arm, or hand rather, begins to shake. And he's like, I guess not. So naturally, he already thinks, oh, she's dead. Like, I got this shit easy. Like, she's traumatized, you know, just by me bringing up that night. But then, you know, and for a while, you know, Adam just start raking in some shots. But then, that's when he makes a comment, what is she even seeing you? And a few moments after that, Yang's eyes blare red, and as Adam goes for a moon slice, all we see is a bit of an explosion, and Yang caught his fucking sword. Now, granted, it wasn't the most powerful moon slice he's ever done, because, you know, I want to give Kruby credit for directly animating it to where, you know, Blake and Yang realize, you know, where the whatever side his sword is on, you attack the other, so that way he can't keep charging his semblance. But then, you know, so she delivers, you know, the finishing shot to break his aura. Even though we don't get to see his aura get shattered, you know, you can hear it with the little static electricity thing. So then, like, you know, Yang says, you know, I may not be faster, but I'm smarter than you are. And so then she throws his sword off the cliff. Adam chases after it, because really without it, you know, he can't fight that well. I mean, yes, he still has his sheath, which is basically, you know, a shotgun, but it's obvious, you know, his semblance is his greatest asset. But then, you know, as he's going for it, Blake uppercuts him off that edge. He springs back up, and her and, you know, Adam both reach for one half of Gamble's shroud. Blake ends up getting it. Yang ends up getting the blade part that ended up breaking off. And Adam gets fucking stabbed from both ends. And something interesting, I didn't I honestly didn't think about it. Because originally, when he just went, oh, after he was stabbed, I thought that, like, you know, that was just his way of saying, oh, so I'm dead. But there's a Tumblr page that goes by the name of Ruby Analysis. And they're really good. You know, they really, I'm assuming, you know, that it's account run by a woman, and if it isn't, you know, sorry for assuming. You know, she really does a good job of, you know, breaking down things and just looking past, like, what were initially shown. And I'm pretty sure she made a post along the lines of, Adam was saying, oh, because he went into that fight thinking that there was no chance he could lose. You know, he's going up against a girl who is clearly fazed by his presence whenever it shows up in a bad way, and also against a girl who he knows is traumatized because he cut off her arm, and so when he gets stabbed and he's killed, he's like, oh, this wasn't supposed to happen. Then, you know, he falls off the cliff, he ends up hitting a rock on the way down. Some people point out how if you listen really closely, you can hear the distinct sound of a crunch, which people believe to be a spine. And even though, you know, we don't get to see his body afterwards, I mean, there's like maybe a 1% chance he's alive. Then the scene after that, you know, Blake, you know, she ends up breaking down. And I thought that was really interesting, because originally, you know, I saw a few people say, oh, well, you know, it was probably because, you know, she just killed a person. Like, unless you're an absolute sadist or, you know, like Tyrion, you know, that's clearly going to shake you up. But people, we really have to remember, there was a point in time to where, like, Adam didn't act the way he did. Like, he wasn't this dude obsessed with being a martyr and a dude who was obsessed with Blake. He put on this mask that he was, you know, he was still a genuinely a good person. Who believed in not just himself become a martyr, but for what the White Fang was, the whole reason why the White Fang was there. And so it's easy to see why she would still break down. Like, yes, Adam became a monster of an individual, but there was still a period of time to where, you know, he put on this mask that he wasn't a horrible person. He may have done some questionable things, but he always was able to convince people he did it, you know, because there was no other choice. Which, you know, not to be exactly true, but then, you know, I found that up, you know, there's a scene with, you know, Yang comforting her, and, you know, Blake, you know, while sobbing, tells Yang, you know, I'm not going to break my promise, to which Yang, you know, looks her dead in the eye and says, I know you won't. And at that point, like, after seeing that, I was just like, all right, they just went from a 90% to probably about 97, 98%. And so then, in the finale, you know, you know, oh, also in that episode, you know, there was that really, really fucking, even though you had to be batshit crazy to do this, but the scene that I thought was really cool, where Ruby, you know, charged into the barrel of Cordovan's gun and basically shot some sort of ice/ground dust at the charging shot Cordovan was using, and ended up encasing the cannon in like half ice, half rock. Ended up basically getting it stuck in the water. And, you know, during all the chaos of that happening, and all the negative emotions that Cordovan was showing, just from being frustrated and angry to, you know, all the protagonists being like, you know, maybe we are in over our heads, they end up attracting a Leviathan, who might as well be Godzilla. and then as well as some sphinxes, and I think the initial scene showed like 3 manticores, but now, you know, Argus is under an invasion by Grimm, you know, and then the volume finale, you know, apparently Blake and Yang were a lot closer than we thought, because they were able to sprint over there no problem with not much aura. Excuse me. And so then they board Manta 5-1, and then they, you know, they're flying about, you know, initially, and then Maria, you know, makes the offhanded comment, just like, listen, I don't want to be the bad guy here, but this is probably the only easy chance we have of flying out. But, you know, Ruby, obviously, you know, they can't do that. And obviously, you know, well, it's not just Ruby. It's everyone, you know, saying, you know, we can't do that. And then, you know, Blake even brings up how, you know, to Maria, just like, you told us a Huntress is supposed to protect no matter what. This doesn't make it any different. Which I found interesting to have Blake say that and everyone else put in their two cents. And the whole time, Jean didn't speak up, just like, you know, my sister, nephew, and sister-in-law still live here, you know. Like, I just thought that was funny. Like, that would have made for a really nice comic relief moment. But then, you know, so then they decide, because the Leviathan, they put up the shields for the city, and the Leviathan literally just blows up the first level, you know. Then, you know, when they're trying to distract the Leviathan or whatever, they're too late, and so the Leviathan ends up breaking through the second shield wall. But then Ruby ends up using a Lancer that Weiss summoned in the previous episode when they were trying to destroy the shields of the mech that Cordovan was using, because she is going to use her Silver-Eyed Warrior abilities on the Leviathan. And even Maria thinks that's too out of line. She's just like, when I said trial by fire, I didn't mean go up against a giant Grimm. But Ruby basically says, what other option do we have? And so, like I covered earlier, you know, Ruby goes through it, you know, and originally it doesn't work because all the bad memories start popping up, you know, and then, but then, you know, she accidentally summons Jin. Jin says, all right, you know what, just this once, I won't charge this against you. I will give you, I will allow you the extra time to better prepare yourself. And so this time, after seeing all the happy memories she made back at Beacon with her team and Team Juniper with Penny, and the last shot of Summer, she's able to use her Silver-Eyed Warrior powers, and she encases the Leviathan, which apparently, I guess the Leviathan is even stronger than the Wyvern that's still frozen at Beacon, because it was able to break apart. Like, I'm not sure how exactly that happened. Like, there hasn't really been an explanation for it, and I haven't seen a thing from this most recent episode of Ruby Rewind where Carrie was on, where and I don't think any of them asked him about it. Yeah, no, the Leviathan starts breaking free, but Cordovan ends up having a change of heart during all this, and she ends up attacking the Grimm, and she ends up drilling away the Leviathan, and she basically tells Ruby, oh, you know, get out of here, kid. And Ruby's just like, well, what about the whole, you know, us stealing an airship thing? Cordovan's just like, eh, I'll purposely leave out one airship missing. Just say it's destroyed in battle or something like that. And so then they're leaving while Cordovan and the rest of the Atlas personnel station there start fighting off the rest of the straggling Grimm. And then, you know, as they're making their way to Atlas, you know, they all had this really nice bonding scene where they all, you know, compliment each other on how they handled everything. You know, and then there's that scene where, you know, Blake tried to, like, take responsibility for the plan not working, and then basically her team tells her, shut the hell up, it's not even close to your fault. You know, there were a lot of things we could have predicted. And, you know, that nice little look scene between her and Ruby, or Ruby and Yang, where, you know, it's basically Ruby being like, I know what's going on. Like, I know. But then, you know, they get to that nice scene of when they come up on Atlas. And the really interesting thing that I saw someone point out on Tumblr about Atlas is that the lower level is literally, it looks as if it's right next to a volcano. And you know, the way the lights are on the bottom part of the city is it makes it seem as if like it really is a contrast between, you know, the slums and the high society. And, obviously, you know, the episode ends with, kind of a not so friendly voice coming on and saying, Manta 5-1, welcome home. So either they know about what happened, or they know that that ship isn't supposed to be there because they didn't radio it in. At first, I thought it sounded like Winter, but then I went back and listened to it, and, you know, I could see why I confused it for, but it now looking during a second rewatch, it didn't sound like it at all. But, you know, that's the full recap of Volume 6. And then, you know, with the credits, you know, the song Nevermore is playing, and it's been confirmed by Jeff Williams that, you know, the song is basically a direct parallel to Adam's theme, Lionized. And the whole central point of that song is basically supposed to be, like, Yang and Blake telling Adam, you know, you're an idiot. A martyr isn't some, you know, the whole purpose of a leader isn't to become a martyr and be used as, like, a signal for, like, violence or something like that. But yeah, no, that's volume 6. Me personally, it is, you know, my favorite volume. Right now, the rankings for my favorite volumes probably go 6, 3, 2, 1, 5, and 4. And yeah, no, it's just, I really hope that this volume is a massive sign of the way the rest of the series is going to be. And, you know, just to, like, you know, when you really do think about it, in an interview, you know, Miles and Carrie brought up how Monty, you know, planned out, I think it was about 20 seasons, but now people, and, you know, people think, okay, every 3 volumes is a season. And I'm not going to get into the math of that right now because I don't want to end up sounding like an idiot, but that now means that we've done 2 seasons. But then Miles and Carrie also said something about, like, anywhere from 13 to 14 volumes would probably be enough to end the series how they would want it to be. So if you really want to look at it like this, Volume 7 could be considered, we're at the halfway point of the series. Things could either get really good for the heroes, or, as I expect it to be, there's going to be less and less cheerful, happy moments. but yeah, no, personally, yeah, no, for me, and this is looking way, way far ahead, you know, I don't know how the series is going to end. For all we know, you know, the 8 people, the 8 kids, mind you, because, like, personally me, I don't see both Bronwyn twins surviving, you know, and if we go by, you know, one of the original theories that came out where, like, by the end of Ruby, or after the maidens were first told about all 4 members of Ruby, they're going to be a maiden, meaning, like, in that case, then neither of the Bronwyn twins are going to be alive, but I just feel as if, you know, Crow probably won't be alive by the time the series end. Raven could possibly, in my opinion, end up being gone in the next 3 volumes just because, you know, she's a target. You know, like, and, you know, if, you know, anything happens like that, and if Yang is present and her and Raven have somewhat reconciled by then Yang could end up having the Spring Maiden power dumped on her. Yeah, no, myself, looking ahead into the future, I do want to see a flashback of, like, Team Stark, and not one spent, like, if it could just be one really big episode, like how episode 3 was, like, almost 30 minutes long, just have that one detailing different points of Team Stark being together with the ending of, like, you know, and the whole point, you can have Crow doing, like, a voiceover to it, like, he could just be, like, it could just be one night where all of them are hanging together, and he ends up telling the story about it, because that is something at this point that's needed, you know? Yeah, no, because that's, like, I got thinking about it, and just, like, all these crazy ideas started going off in my head, and I was like, I don't know why, but I have this dead set theory that what if Summer isn't dead, but she's just become, like, a grim hybrid that Salem has been waiting to use just in case things got a bit too dire? Because, you know, that could end up creating a really, really, really sad fucking moment to where Ruby's like, the only way I can end up defeating my mom is via the Silver Eyes, and I don't know if that's going to kill her or free her. Yeah, no, and that's, like, also just, like, to me, like, Ruby could honestly, like, and I know a few years ago Bernie Burns came out and said that he would like to see a live-action movie of Ruby. Me, I'm all for a movie of Ruby, but don't make it live action. It's pretty sick animation. I honestly don't think that whoever they partnered with to make it happen could end up making a good live action Ruby movie. But yeah, no, to me, I would just, like, and this could just be overconfidence in, you know, the cast and, you know, all the behind the scenes personnel. But I really do think if things go right, you know, they can make it to where, like, Ruby ends with a movie. You know, like, maybe have it to where, like, the last 2 volumes, or, like, the last volume, they finally go back to Vale, they reclaim Beacon, they get the last relic, and then, like, there's this scene where, because at this point, like, because I saw something to where, and I think it might have been the episode of Ruby Rewind that Lindsay Jones was on, but she said that Ruby is 17 now, meaning everyone else is 19, meaning by volume 14, if that is how many volumes are going to be before it ends, they would all be, oh god, what, like, it seems like every, they could probably be, like, all of them 23 and Ruby be 21 or something around those times. And then, like, you know, they end up having a thing where it could be like, you know, they're just like, if we're going to win this, we need every Huntsman available. 9 people can't win this war, you know? Like, and it could literally be a thing where they assemble every single Huntsman they know, all the teams from, like, all the remaining teams from Beacon, all the teams from Haven, Shade, Atlas, and, you know, you create a lot of drama around that, because they would have, they Team Ruby specifically would probably tell everyone, just like, all right, we're not going to bullshit and lie to you, here's the real truth behind everything, and obviously, everyone's not going to agree with that, but, you know, I just think there's so many possibilities with it. But yeah, no, that is the, wrapping things up, that is the first episode of the Ruby Podcast. I personally had a lot of fun doing this. I was just doing it all off the top of my brain. And so I was happy that I was still able to remotely remember a lot of things, because even with volumes in the past that I really enjoyed, I was not able to really do a full recollection of everything. But yeah, no. I can't tell you when the next episode is probably going to be. I'm probably going to give it a few more weeks, let a few more, you know, allow myself some more time to think things over, think about possible theories for volume 7. I'm pretty sure on the last episode of the latest episode of Ruby Rewind, Carrie hinted at new character designs in regards to outfits happening in volume 7. So that's something that could definitely be talked about. But yeah, no, this is something that I really think I could have a lot of fun with. Maybe in the future I'll be able to, like, end up making friends with people within the community and end up having them on an episode and talking about it with them. And, you know, hopefully end up getting you guys, if you end up sticking around, which I do hope you do, for a new episode answer, like, kind of have some episodes that are Q&A based, stuff like that. But yeah, no, thank you for listening to this first episode of the Ruby Cast. I hope you all have a nice day. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.